On This Week in Enterprise Tech, running Linux on Windows just got a whole lot easier, plus a call to action to the industry for new computer architectures. And we take you through the new National Cyber Defense Initiative. And Brian Curtis and I talk with a great guest, Paul Reynolds, CEO and co-founder of Torch, to talk AR and VR software design. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 309, recorded September 21st, 2018. Torch AR VR design for the masses. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Grammarly, a communication tool that helps you improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for your work, school, even on the go. It's a great way to double check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly Premium today at grammarly.com/enterprise. And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/enterprise. And by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need a little help from some of the top tech enterprise professionals in this industry, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, welcome back, sir. Thanks for being here.
It is always a pleasure, Mr. Maruska. Happy to be here on a Friday when I'm trying to put things in order. It seems a little company called Microsoft is throwing a party here in town next week. I'm filling up my dance card for that particular hootenanny.
I'm definitely not looking forward to bringing the rain from here to there, but are there any particular things that you're focusing on while you're there?
Well, the three things that I'm covering heavily, of course, I live in the world of security, and I'm talking to a number of security folks, but also looking at, depending on how you phrase it, artificial intelligence or machine learning, and there are a number of folks who want to talk to me about that, and IoT. And when you draw the Venn diagram, the place where all three of those overlap, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on, and I'm looking forward to having some great conversations down at the Orange County Convention Center.
Fantastic. And I love those Venn diagrams. So fantastic. Well, folks, this show couldn't be without Twyatt. This wouldn't be Twyatt without our great producer, Mr. Brian Chi. Mr. Brian Chi, Chibert, are you safe from all the hurricanes? You've been able to kind of work through them and stay safe?
So far, so good. About all we have left over is not a lot of wind and heat. You know, Alexa tells me it's only the mid 80s. It feels like the mid 90s. And sadly, my air conditioner is not keeping up. But such is life. Next week, I'll be attending one of my ex-students' wedding in Vermont. So I'm looking forward to the cooler weather.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys for being here. It wouldn't be Twyatt without you. I'm definitely looking forward to today's show, where we're taking you through the National Cyber Defense Initiative. Plus, we have a great guest, Paul Reynolds, CEO, co-founder of Torch, to talk about AR and VR software design. But first, like we always do, let's jump into those blips. Can it be hard or annoying to set up Internet of Things on your network? Well, some companies use cameras for devices and QR codes to get you set up easier. Otherwise, if you have an LCD, you can enter in your username and passwords, your credentials in there. Well, Amazon thinks they have a new approach that can work on any IoT device. They are coining it Wi-Fi Simple Setup. Now, within 30 seconds of powering on an IoT device, it will be able to receive encrypted credentials for the Wi-Fi so it can automatically connect. Now, this is made possible by using Amazon's Wi-Fi lockers to store Wi-Fi credentials and share them with smart home devices. Now, along with Wi-Fi Simple Setup, Amazon also announced a plug-and-play smart home kit called Alexa Connect Kit. Now, it starts with a module that has a Bluetooth LE and Wi-Fi and real-time OS that companies can put in their products in order to make them smart, like Amazon's newly announced microwave. Now, Amazon's Wi-Fi simple setup is part of their long-term plan called Frustration-Free Setup, which is designed to make all types of electronics devices easier to immediately to use. Now, this sounds cool and all, but I smell exploits coming from this type of technology. What do you think?
Well, the U.S. is getting offensive on the cyber battlefield. In a news briefing this week, the Trump administration confirmed that it has authorized the use of offensive cyber operations against foreign enemies. The announcement aligns with a new, broader policy to relax the rules governing U.S. use of cyber weapons to deter adversaries. The presidential directive allows the military to use tactics that fall below the use of force or those that would lead to, quote, death, destruction, or significant economic impacts, end quote. But the U.S. military and government agencies can use cyber operations to protect the nation's systems and networks. Now, no specifics about the operations were released, and the government has not named a particular threat they're responding to, but it's widely known that the White House is worried about foreign governments targeting U.S. networks, specifically around the November elections, and it cannot be a coincidence that the Pentagon released a new strategy this week highlighting Russia and China as top U.S. adversaries. Now, this is a big topic with a lot more to cover. We're going to be talking more about it in just a few minutes down in the Bites.
Well, you know, we all need to be able to go and prototype, learn, tinker, do all kinds of things. There's an awful lot of viewers that have said, hey, how do I get started on eating the learning curve for Linux? Well, Microsoft has a way. So here we go. Microsoft and Canonical have been working for some time to make Ubuntu and Windows play nice with each other. Ubuntu was the first distribution supported in the Windows subsystem for Linux, and now an Ubuntu image is available through Hyper-V Quick Create, which offers three-click creation of virtual machines. The system image has Ubuntu Desktop 18.04 LTS configured and ready to go, and this showcases some of the other Linux integration work that Microsoft has been doing. The Hyper-V virtual machine client, virtual machine connection, and so forth, has two ways of working. The normal way is to display the output of the virtual video card that the virtual machine uses. That's a lot of virtuals. And similarly, to emulate PS2 mouse and keyboard input as if the client were the physical hardware. This works with any operating system. The virtual video card supports rudimentary modes like VGA and the text mode used by DOS. It can also support high-resolution graphics modes when used with a suitable display driver, but it is relatively slow and inflexible. This is one of the experiences I've had with an awful lot of virtual Linux machines, but you know what? Most of my machines I run in command line anyway, so big deal. Anyway, I've been playing with VMs on my laptop for ages, but for those that are just starting on the learning curve, this is certainly a nice way to start with lots less pain than I had to go through. Just keep in mind that this is Linux running under Windows, so don't expect blazing speeds like you might get when installing Ubuntu on a bare machine.
Is it the golden age of computer architecture? Well, according to David Patterson, a University of California professor, Google engineer, and RISC processor pioneer, it is. And he feels there's no better time to be a computer architect. Why? Well, because Moore's Law is over, and it's the post-Moore's Law era. To quantify the claims, performance used to double every 18 months, but last year, performance only grew 3%, meaning it will only double every 20 years. This doesn't cause a meek outlook on the industry for computer architects. This sparks their passion to move forward and find solutions. Now, to Patterson, this is a signal to the industry to start finding new programming languages and system architectures that can bring the speed of innovation back. Now, as he's quoted, the Turing Awards are waiting to be picked up if people would just work on these things. He actually targeted Python and said, if Python could be rewritten in C, it could actually get a 50 times speed jump. And with other improvements, they can get a speed improvement by a factor of 1,000. The interesting point here is that machine learning is pushing for more innovation in this area. The industry is taking different approaches to increase performance of modeling and processing modeling for machine learning. Google with their Tensor processor units. the NVIDIA's GPUs and Microsoft's FPGAs has the industry thinking about performance and targeting architectures rather than more general approaches. In fact, there are 45 startups in today's market targeting such a problem to increase performance for machine learning. Now, it looks like it's only a matter of time we see more focus on the ability to squeeze more performance out of everyday computing on top of the innovation we're already seeing.
Retailers are almost the worst when it comes to computer security. Third-party risk management firm Security Scorecard recently analyzed a total of 1,444 domains in the retail industry, each of them having an IP footprint of at least 100, and they passively monitored the externally facing IPs of the retail domains for about 5 months to see what vulnerabilities they could find. The exercise showed the retail industry had the second lowest application security performance among major sectors. In a list of 18 industries, the retail sector ranked 17th, just above the entertainment industry in terms of having the most vulnerable applications. If that's not bad enough, the survey from the year before showed the industry with better security, so things are trending in the wrong direction. Now, retailers also rank dead last in terms of their ability to protect against social engineering attacks. According to the report, criminals employing phishing and other social engineering methods to steal data and commit fraud were likely to have more success with retailers than organizations in any other industry. The industry association that deals with credit card issues, called the PCI, has standards that any retailer accepting credit cards must adhere to, but retailers fared especially poorly with respect to PCI DSS Requirement 6, which pertains to application security. When looking for causes of the failures, Security Scorecard said a point-in-time approach to PCI compliance rather than continuous security could be one reason so many retailers appear to have a hard time with the application security requirement. And the retail industry's generally younger workforce may be a factor in the social engineering score, since many retail sector employees who are targets of phishing and social engineering scams, well, they just don't know enough about the threat to be able to recognize it.
Well, Microsoft's Managed Desktop is going to let Redmond handle your desktop devices. Just as the cloud freed many administrators from the day-to-day tedium of tending to Exchange servers and infrastructure like domain controllers, Microsoft Managed Desktop, aka MMD, could do the same for the corporate desktop. The new service combines Microsoft 365 Enterprise, which is a combined Windows 10, Office 365, and Enterprise Mobility Bundle, hardware leasing, and cloud-based device management to deliver secured, updated, and maintained systems, all with software maintenance handled by Microsoft. Redmond says that it's offering the service in response to customer desire to hand off day-to-day device management tasks and spend more time addressing the needs of their organizations. The new service will work on what the company calls modern hardware, systems with the right hardware security features and remote management capabilities. This will include both first-party Surface systems and, in coming months, third-party machines from companies such as Dell and HP. With MMD, customers will be able to put their credentials into systems straight from the OEM. Machines will then retrieve their configuration, role in device management, and install necessary applications using Windows Autopilot. There should be no need for IT personnel to ever touch the machines. Wow. I certainly predicted desktop as a service over the last several years, but I thought it was going to be virtual desktops hosted at your local ISP. The piece I missed is that Microsoft has been working hard in the background to get those huge images that you used to need for Active Directory user desktops slimmed down.
Now, as cryptocurrencies gain more visibility in the financial world, so is the size of the targets on their backs. Now, back in January, we heard about one of Japan's largest cryptocurrency Bitcoin exchanges, Coincheck, being robbed of $530 million. Now, this drew a good amount of scrutiny from Japan's Financial Services Agency, or FSA. Well, they have a reason to be worried, it seems. This past week, Japan's cryptocurrency exchange, Zafe, has been robbed of $60 million worth of digital coins. Now, how long did the hack take? Well, just 2 hours. But the attack was found right away. It was uncovered days later when server problems surfaced and sparked an investigation. Now, cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin and Monocoin and Bitcoin Cash, were stolen from the exchange's online wallet, where hackers were able to gain access to through the internet. Of the $59.6 million stolen, almost $20 million belonged to its parent company, Tech Bureau, while $40 million belonged to the clients of the exchange. Now, Japan's financial services agency, FSA, is not very happy and started to review ways for new regulation on these cryptocurrencies. Now, the NEM Foundation did come out with a response to what was going on, explaining that the NEM blockchain itself remains secure and the NEM wallets also remain secure and intact. Now, what enthusiasts are actually calling out is that this is just another signal to people to get their coins off exchanges, use them for trading, but don't put them on exchanges. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites, and we're going to talk a little bit about the National Cyber Defense Initiative that just came out. But first, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Grammarly. Now, there's always that one tool that helps you so much that you just keep going back to it over and over and over again. And for me, when I write, it's definitely Grammarly. Now, not only does it help me write better content, but it also helps me write better emails and better documents all around, all different types of documents. Now, not only do you get really great features on the free version, you get spell checker, you get grammar checker. It can literally make you a better writer. But Grammarly Premium adds a bunch of really great features. In addition to spell and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps with advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions. Now, get this percentage. 76% of surveyed premium users now find writing more enjoyable because of Grammarly. Now, for me, it definitely makes it more fun and more trustworthy to write because I can actually lean on Grammarly for better writing. Now, it integrates with Microsoft Word and Outlook, and they have extensions in all the browsers for Chrome, Edge, Firefox, and Safari, and there's also a desktop app to help you along. Now, do you travel a lot? Well, if you like to take public transportation and you work on your iPhone or your Android phone everywhere, well, Grammarly has you covered as well. It works with iOS and Android just as well. Now, for me, on iOS, the Grammarly keyboard is a lifesaver. Autocomplete can sometimes fail you. And look at all those funny posts out there people have with autocomplete fails. Now, the Grammarly keyboard can keep you safe. Not only will it help you write better, but it just looks better too. Now, if you haven't tried Grammarly yet, go out and get it right now. It'll literally make your writing life better. Now, go to grammarly.com/enterprise to get 20% off Grammarly Premium today. That's grammarly.com/enterprise. And we thank Grammarly for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, we've all heard of state-sponsored actors that they've looked and tried to change elections, cause panic on the net, attack companies, but we've never really heard about any responses on how to handle this going forward. There's a new paper published this week coined the Cybersecurity Strategy Paper, and outlines how the U.S. will actually defend our homeland by protecting networks, systems, functions, and data. So some of this content talks about promoting American prosperity by nurturing and securing thriving digital economies with strong domestic innovation. It helps expand influence of the open, interoperable, reliable, and secure internet. Now, there's a bunch of blurbs in here, just keeps going on and on. But essentially what it talks about is how to go on the offense when we have to be on the defense. The paper outlines some things here, and I'll talk about a couple of them. It starts with the securing federal networks using Homeland Security to secure federal departments and agency networks. It also talks about securing critical infrastructure. Now, it's going to work with private sectors to determine risks, also mitigate more vulnerabilities, and also have swift and concise consequences by using a range of tools against the enemy, including prosecution, as well as economic sanctions. In fact, they are going to also fund research for the National Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience Research to help develop better security. And they also want to include and improve incident responses for all victims and fight back using offensive techniques. Now, it goes on and on and on. But again, basically what it's saying is, We're going to take the initiative here that when things happen, we're going to actually fight back. And in fact, we might fight back in ways where it would hopefully strike a little bit of fear in our adversaries. Okay, so guys, I want to go over to you because there's a ton of stuff in this document. It's 40 pages long. It talks a little bit of politics, a little bit of information. But basically what it comes down to is that the U.S. is going to start fighting back without without telling anybody. They're basically going to say, hey, if there's some hackers that are going to come along and they're going to start attacking infrastructure or industries or bureaus or whatever, they're going to start fighting back in some ways. And they don't actually outline how they're going to do that, but they basically say, we're going to do it, so be ready. Now, I'm going to throw this over to you, Curtis, first, because you brought it up in the blips. Is this something that's actually going to make a change? Is this going to have veer hackers away from actually doing what they're already doing?
Well, I'm actually going to disagree with one of the things you said. You said that this time we're going to go on the offense without telling anyone. I think the issue is that we have been doing at least limited offensive operations for quite a long time.
Right.
The difference now is that we are telling people. We are being very obvious about our willingness to do that. Now, before, anything that we did offensively was always done in the shadows. You know, systems might fail, DOS attacks might go on, strange things could happen, but we never officially took credit for any of it. And our official position was always one of purely defensive cyber operations, for the reason that if the internet, if cyberscape became an all-out battlefront, at this point, it could quite literally cripple the world's economy. Well, now we've taken the gloves off. To use a physical weapon analogy, we've gone from the concealed carry that so many states use, where someone can get a license to have, say, a concealed weapon, but they must keep it concealed, to open carry. Now we're telling everyone that our cyber defenses are packing and we're willing to use them.
Right. Now, one interesting thing here is, and I want to throw this over to Chibert, because I'm wondering if here now we're basically saying that at the very kind of minimalistic side of things, a view of this, is are we just going into a cyber war now? Is that basically what we're doing?
Well, to an extent, we have been in one for quite a while. Let's use an example. We were running the Interop trade show in New York. And Interop has huge pipes and lots of address space. When you have the 45/8 network, you make yourself one heck of a big target. One of the things we used to do, because we weren't allowed to fight back, it was illegal, was we had special devices. They're basically pretending to be honey nets. And we had this one hacker, and they made a connection into our honey net. And then the device went and did a TCP back off. We actually had this kid on the hook with a TCP back off and then a little bit more and then dribble. And we had him on the line for 2 days. In the meantime, we were able to go and find track where he was and then hand the data over to the FBI. Well, this kind of thing has been happening all over the United States. I know lots and lots of people that are starting to do, and they're gathering a lot of intelligence. But the laws haven't allowed for anything offensive. We personally had the skills and we had the equipment. We could have dumped on this kid and took down his net, but that's not good. So now with the offensive capability, so-called open carry that Kurt alluded to, maybe now we can go after the kids that don't know, should know better, but don't, and be able to go and deal with them, take them off the line, and then also start dealing with some of these bad actors that are coming from different countries that at the moment, because it's extraterritorial, we can't do anything about. So will it make a difference? I hope so. Will it really make a difference? I think we're going to start having a shooting war. I think it's going to escalate. And then I'm hoping something happens maybe at the UN where people maybe calmer heads will prevail. I don't know. It's could be bad, could be good. It's going to be a double-edged sword, if you ask me.
So you brought up a good point. I want to get back to the fact that you say could it work, could it not work. I think we definitely should talk about that. But I think, Curtis, I wanted to throw it over to you again, because you brought it up in your blip. You talked a little bit about potentially relaxing rules governing the U.S. using cyber weapons. So now, if we know about some of these rules, I'm not sure if you're aware of some of the rules, but if you are, I'd be interested to hear about those. And could they actually affect the American citizens too as well.
Well, let's talk about a couple of very concrete examples where I think we could see something happen. One is just purely cyber. It is known that international government-related organizations have infiltrated parts of the U.S. critical energy infrastructure. We know that they have gotten persistence on the machines controlling our electric distribution grid, on some of the pipeline gateways. There are a number of places where there is no doubt that there is malware in place. So what is our response? Now, traditionally and formally, our response has been that we could go in, root it out, get it off, and do what we could, can to protect the perimeter and keep it off. Now, we are saying, although this hasn't been explicitly stated, that if we know who is doing this, and trust me, we do, should they decide to show signs of pulling the trigger on some of this malware, they have critical infrastructure too. And their critical infrastructure could be in as much danger as ours. Think of it as the cyber equivalent of the old mutually assured destruction doctrine that was in use around nuclear weapons for the better part of 50 years. Another one's going to be a little bit more difficult, and that takes place not only within the network with things like hacking into the servers and applications of our political parties and of our voting infrastructure, but in terms of the information, in terms of genuinely fake news and social networks. We're now saying that should someone make use of all of these in an attempt to influence our elections, that we can do the same thing. So I think what we're doing by making this public statement is telling two or three key adversaries, and there's no doubt, to be brutally honest, there are four that we care about deeply. There's Russia, there is China, there's North Korea, there's Iran. If we want them to know that whatever they do to us, we are willing to do to them and more. And the hope is that by making that very public statement, everyone will keep their heads cool and the battle won't escalate to a genuine, as Siebert said, shooting war.
Right. Yeah, the paper actually has accusations against China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And it actually calls out saying that they are conducting reckless cyber attacks that harmed American and international businesses and our allies' partners without paying costs, likely to deter future cyber aggression. So they are actually directly calling out these places in hopes that they get the message. But it'll be curious to see if it actually does anything. Now, Siebert, I wanted to throw back to you. The paper just actually goes through a little bit of information about how the government wants to get more involved in when there is actually attacks, even hacks that happen, even in the private sector. And they want to, you know, obviously they want a better response. They want to provide better postmortem on these things. The question to you is, you know, they can't really do that without really more a government regulation here, right?
Well, I'm going to flip this just a tad. I think this might also be in response to the fact that the private sector is more than just a little PO'd about all these attacks that are happening. Now, keep firmly in mind, just because it's the government doesn't mean they have the best tools. Some of these private sector corporations have amazing tools. And, you know, the private sector tends to develop them for the public sector. So keeping that firmly in mind, we're probably going to get some government regulation, but I think it's going to be more along the lines of trying to keep the private sector from having their own mercenary cyber army to fight back, because that could be, you know, that could be the nuclear attack against some of these people. Because could you imagine, you know, some large corporation getting super? I'm just gonna do a what if, you know, what if? You know, let's talk about someone that could potentially get really PO'd if they were attacked. Say someone like Elon Musk. You know, just what if? And if he gets really, really pissed off and he goes and says to his cyber expert, goes, I've had enough of, it's enough. Punish them. That could be like, you know, burning down a forest to get this one person. So I think the government's going to have to do some regulations just to prevent the private sector from striking back or flailing around and creating a lot of collateral damage. Do I want to see this? No. Do we think it's going to happen? Yes. So I am hoping the U.S. Cyber Command actually goes and does something about this before the private sector gets so PO'd that they're going to start flailing around.
Right. Actually, Emily Strange actually brings up a good point in the chat room. She says, you know, we might get left behind because we've been always kind of standing on this high moral ground. Now, if we attack back, it kind of positions us a little bit better in this area and hopes that, you know, we position ourselves to not be victims in this place. So I think that's a very interesting position. Let's hope it actually happens. Now, Kurt, I wanted to throw back to you. And talk a little bit about, you had mentioned before about some of the critical infrastructures that could be affected here. Do you have any more comments about that?
Well, for the U.S., there are two primary, you know, broadly speaking, critical infrastructures that we worry about. One is energy. And this is one of those terrible cases where, to be brutally honest, the thing that protects our electrical grid the most is its relatively primitive state. We do not have a fully integrated electric infrastructure. Our distribution grid is divided up, chopped up, and there are some fairly primitive switches between them. So it's possible for a particular region to be taken down, very difficult for anything beyond regional to go down because of one strike. Now, it doesn't mean that a series of coordinated strikes couldn't do something, but those are much, much more difficult to pull off. The other thing, of course, is the financial infrastructure, and we have seen the kind of shocks that it can inflict upon itself. We have seen 1,000-point swings in a matter of minutes. Now, imagine if someone were genuinely trying to see just how far they could move a market before the circuit breakers kicked in. What would happen if they started moving the market and they had developed attacks against those circuit breakers? Those are the sorts of things that could have exceptional consequences, as could things against pieces that we really don't think about if we're not part of the market. There are markets in reinsurance that have massive implications. Most people don't understand how interest rates are set around the world. Those, we know from experience, can be manipulated. If someone were trying to manipulate them for damage rather than for profit, there's no telling what might happen. So we do have a number of areas where we're genuinely vulnerable. And while we work very hard to protect all of these, the complexity makes it much easier to find a gap, find a seam where an attacker can insert their attack. And I think what we're trying to do with this statement is make the broad position that even if an attacker finds this seam, finds the gap, and is able to position themselves to do damage, they should worry that we are ready and willing to respond in a way that could hurt them as badly as they're hurting us.
Right. Now, you bring up a good point. I want to get Cheebert's thoughts on this. Like, they, you know, at this point, the question would be, do hackers really believe that there's little price to pay if they continue this? Like, I think the question would be if they're really kind of thinking, if we keep doing it, We won't get kind of reprimanded. Oh, but now we're going to get reprimanded. I don't know. Like, do you really believe that this is going to stop anything? I mean, is it obviously we're calling out some different state actors here, specific ones. But, you know, the question would be maybe, hey, is this going to change anything? Or should we have, like Curtis said before, should we have stayed more covert about this and just said, hey, we're going to fight back, but that's really it. We're not going to tell you who we're going to do it, how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it. And we're just going to do it. And I don't know if that would have been a little bit better than just actually calling things out. Question back to you.
I'm going to answer this with a what if scenario. And my what if scenario is right now the world is deathly afraid of our current president. He's been known to do a lot of things just based on, you know, whatever he feels like doing. Now, if we start saying we're going to open carry and we're going to fight back, there's a really, really good chance the other countries are going to worry that in the fight back, they're going to become collateral damage and, you know, critical infrastructure, their internet, their financials, you know, all kinds of different things. Here's the part where I'm speculating. I'm hoping that enough people get afraid of becoming collateral damage that maybe, just maybe, the United Nations starts doing something. You know, they've been kind of, you know, not real effective in the terms of cyber infrastructure and so forth, but maybe to prevent a worldwide cyber war, we start actually seeing something happening in the United Nations. And if we had something, maybe we can start getting some of these other nations to allow us to go and grab some of these idiots. You know, maybe we'll have some sort of detente, just like we did for nuclear weapons. Who knows? You know, I'm speculating. I'm probably wrong, but I would love to see this happen. I love science fiction, you know? And the reality is we're going to have a balance of power. And if we don't have a balance of power, the internet's going to become a smoking hole. And the world economy will collapse and things like that, blah, 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 blah. We need to have some sort of balance, and I'm hoping this is a bluff from the White House.
Right. All right, well, this is a great discussion, but I do want to move on to our guests because we're going to talk a little bit about 3D prototyping. But first, we want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's DigitalOcean. Now, as a developer, I can tell you that the ability to experiment with your apps and actually put them on truly hosted environments is sometimes hard. And if it was easier to deploy to hosted services, you could focus more on your innovation rather than all the logistics. Now, DigitalOcean removes the impedance of cloud deployments and hosting and make it easier than ever to deploy your applications and code and store things on cloud storage without all the steps in between. Now, I love all the names they love to give stuff, starting with DigitalOcean's Droplets, which are actually super scalable virtual machines that you can add on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities with just one click of a button. They also have really great one-click deployment models that can make it easy to bootstrap your project, whether you want to add a specific distribution of Linux, or you just want to one-click Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, and more, or how about a one-click deploy of an application stack. You can add Docker, LAMP, MongoDB, Node.js, MySQL, and more with just one click. Not only is it easy to deploy, it's actually super easy to manage as well. Now, VM snapshots are super simple to take and manage. Now, for me, that gives me peace of mind that the last known good state is always just one click away. Plus, team management and unified collaboration helps teams manage and scale your infrastructure and apps. Now, you need more security for your infrastructure. Well, one click and actually adds cloud firewall for your Droplet or your Droplet groups. Now, get this. Cloud firewalls are free. Now, don't let that free tag fool you. These actually firewalls are not just some low-tier systems. They're not just for testing either. These are production-ready firewalls that can scale with your business or app. Now, to meet the demands in the market, DigitalOcean follows the great model of pay-for-play pricing. It's not only clear and concise, but it also helps you model out the demands of your application and services as they grow. No more complexity when it comes to understanding your future bills and paying your current ones. You want more storage? Just go ahead and add more block storage to meet the needs of your application. Add just 10 cents per gigabyte per month. You have to worry less about adding more peace of mind to your application as it scales out. Now, as your site starting to become more popular and scale quickly, well, load balancers are actually highly available, fully managed services that works right out of the box and can be deployed as fast as droplets can. Now, if you're like me, you love to write scripts to manage things. Now, DigitalOcean has you covered as well. As an API guy, I can tell you they do have some pretty great APIs that use standard HTTP requests to actually deploy and manage thousands of droplets and resources in a simple programmatic way. Now, there are a ton of reasons you should consider DigitalOcean, but even some of the more extra stuff here that they don't charge you extra for, like enterprise class SSDs, 99.9% uptime SLA, full DNS management, and more. DigitalOcean has you covered. There's no reason why you shouldn't go out and try DigitalOcean right now, especially to support Twi. Go to do.co/enterprise. And even if you think you might start a project in the future, or you want to start one right now, or you have one already started, go out right now, sign up today, receive a free $100 credit at do.co/enterprise. That's do.co/enterprise for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support in this week in enterprise tech. Well, folks, this is my favorite part of the show. We get to bring some experts in from the industry to talk tech with our Twiat Riot. And today we're actually focusing on AR and VR with Paul Reynolds, CEO and co-founder of Torch. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're down in Portland, right? Is the weather as dreary as it is up here?
No, it's beautiful here right now. So we went straight from heat to mild, sunny, pleasant weather. But we'll catch up with you soon enough.
Well, I might have to take a trip to Portland before I head to Orlando, because that's the only place I'm going to get sun. But before we actually jump into ARVR, our audiences love to hear about origin stories. Can you maybe give us a quick journey through your experiences until you hit Torch?
Yeah, I worked in software, primarily video games, for about 10 or 15 years. Got out of the video game industry and consulted for 7 or 8 years, doing a lot of video game, using a lot of video game tech for non-gaming applications. And I really got into augmented reality a little too early, about 2012. And I wound up at a company called Magic Leap. I joined them in early 2014, helped grow that company for a couple years, and built a lot of their developer tools and the teams around that. And saw a lot of opportunities in 3D computing coming this way, and decided it was time to get back to being my own boss and starting our own company. So we formed Torch early last year here in Portland, and we've been working towards our first product ever since.
That's super cool. Now you talk a little bit about obviously 3D and making it easier. Now, there are tools for designers and developers alike out there for building just mobile and web applications, whether it's Sketch or using Zeppelin for sharing and Adobe XD. But this is just a way for people to kind of step into the 3D realm. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, you hit it right on the head. Basically, if you look at how software application development's evolved over the past, especially 5 years, we've gone very design first when it comes to cloud applications and mobile applications. So we finally figured out, after decades of engineering a piece of code and then handing it to someone and saying, can you make this usable and match our brand and be efficient, we evolved our tooling on the 2D side to say, well, let's design a functional prototype first. Let's get all the stakeholders signed off on it, and let's talk around the end result and then engineer towards that. And that part of the ecosystem just has not existed for 3D until now.
Right. I mean, those tools are fairly easy to use. They kind of get you bootstrapped pretty quickly. And in fact, me being as a developer, I actually play with Sketch quite a bit, and it makes me, I actually can build things pretty quickly and actually export it and actually get to try stuff out, which is pretty neat. Now, how is Torch actually doing this? What is it? How are you actually making it easier? Is it just like UI driven? Is it wizard driven? How is it actually driven?
Yeah. So what we did was, is we spent a lot of the past year talking to professional designers, experienced designers. So designers is a very overloaded term. In our world, we're talking about the people that do the user experience of applications. And they are used to using tools like Sketch and Envision and Figma to put together these functional prototypes visually. And they usually respond to user input, and it's very view-based. So we took that model and we applied it to the 3D space. And the way we decided to do it was all on a mobile device. So there was kind of three main pain points we identified when we really started digging into why is this process so hard and expensive and difficult. And dealing with 3D assets is difficult. They're not as easy to use as a PNG or a PSD. Building something functional without writing any code is almost impossible with the old tool chains and workflows. And then collaborating with people. So, you know, a lot of these 2D design prototyping environments are moving to the cloud pretty quickly because of the collaboration and sharing aspect. And so we figured out a way to fold in to solve those pain points with one platform. And we actually run on top of augmented reality. So our first product is a mobile application for iPad and iPhone to start, and we'll be adding Android support later. And the reason why is with their AR kit capabilities on the iOS side, we can actually have someone walk around a 3D object or walk around in a 3D coordinate space, whereas the old way would have been kind of using your mouse and keyboard to try to navigate the space on a screen, like a first-person shooter game almost. And so we wanted to give people this very intuitive sense of working with 3D directly as possible. So it's all visual, and the main components of that are analogous to how screen applications are built. You have scenes instead of screens, which is kind of your spatial arrangement of these assets, and then you connect interactivity by responding to input generated by the user, and then that can trigger changes to the scene or can trigger changes to other objects. And you can actually hook up some pretty complex logic that way. And then we just make it super easy to pull in 2D and 3D assets. So we try to eliminate, we process those on the cloud side and try to eliminate all the ways you can kind of trip yourself up trying to get to that point.
That's pretty neat. Now, you talked a little bit about, the kind of effort getting into it. Now, you guys have a demo video of actually getting and authoring an example, right?
Yeah. That one's called the Torch Interaction Authoring Example. It's just a quick peek at how someone can very easily drag assets in. So that's dragging in from what we call the object drawer at the bottom and just visually placing it. And then what's happening here is we're going to add an interaction to that yellow cube. We're going to target the chair, and we're basically telling Torch that this particular interaction, we want to change the color of the chair to yellow to match the cube. And so that shows you your end state. And then once you save it, you hit play to test it. And then you tap the cube and it changes the chair. So it's really that simple, the ability to target other objects or to tell the project to change itself kind of lays this nice groundwork for hooking up prototypes or storyboards. But there's also a real-time collaboration aspect. So because we're on these mobile devices, you can invite a bunch of people in to kind of real-time edit with you, similar to like Google Docs in a lot of ways, to kind of talk around a project and really iterate collaboratively around that. And so it's all about making 3D super fast and accessible, so it's a part of the planning process and the concepting process as early as possible.
It's interesting because these other design apps, it's even simpler than some of those, because I've used Figma before in InDesign, and it takes a lot more clicks, a lot more configuration to kind of get to that kind of decision-making tree that you can get to, and it looks like even in this app. And then you kind of add the sharing capabilities on top of it, but not only just sharing, but you're saying you also can collab. And so other people can actually change the design as well if they have the app?
If you want them to, yes.
Oh, that's really cool. That's awesome.
Yes. So we've got some examples that'll be on our new website that show two people working in the same project at the same time. It's really cool. I can't wait to see how people really leverage that, because not only can you be collaborating with someone in the same physical space, because keep in mind, we're running on augmented reality, so you're seeing the real environment at the same time, but you can also have someone completely remote working on the same project with you. So it opens up these interesting modalities that we haven't really had a lot of exposure to yet, which is like we're all talking about the same 3D scene that we're looking at, but we're talking about it on our conference room table and you're talking about it in your home office. But we can still see it in all these contexts, but also talk about it like we're talking around the same project. So there's a lot of interesting opportunities there that really just haven't been exposed to most people.
Right. So, with this particular thing, what kind of disciplines or maybe personas are you guys targeting? Is it like a whole set of them? Is it just designers? What other disciplines maybe are you focusing on here?
Yeah. So the core product right now is focused on just that simple building up of scenes and interactivity and collaborating around that. We haven't really added yet a lot of deep features to any specific industry or discipline. So we want to see what people do with it. But we have found the most traction and we resonate the most with people that are on the user interface side of things and experience design side of things. So it's typically a designer at a large enterprise that's working on product and working on the UI side of things, or it's a creative team at a branding agency that's working with a lot of large enterprises. So generally we just say a professional experience designer because there's so many roles kind of packed up in there. But the nice thing is because we do have this collaboration feature, we do run on pretty ubiquitous hardware. We're trying to pull other disciplines into the process. Like if you think about it, like right now today, if you were a CIO and you said, we should really be looking into augmented reality for our roadmap, how do we get started? There's a lot of unfamiliar territory you have to explore around video game development and those tools. And then usually you don't have that talent in-house to work on that. So you either train up one of your people to explore it, or you go to an agency, or you contract out. And so already to even just figure out if AR, it makes sense for what you're trying to accomplish, you're already committing to this investment of time and money. And so so we want to actually make this such a collaborative platform that a UX designer uses it to really show the best possible ways that AR could be meaningful to either an internal application or an external product. But most importantly, that they can share that very, very early with the C-suite or, the marketing team and the engineering team in particular. So when they go to build this, that it's something that everybody's kind of in alignment on. Right now, that's just too hard to do with the way they've been built in the past.
Fantastic. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about 3D prototyping and how the market kind of begs for these types of tools like Torch. But first, we want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. Now, I use LastPass so often, I don't even know I'm using it anymore. It's one of those favorite tools that I don't even have to think about using anymore. You have your username and passwords for every site on the go, wherever you're at. For me, I actually have 5 or 6 different bank accounts, and you're not supposed to remember those. You're not supposed to remember the username and passwords for those. I mean, there's so many. I have different ones for every site. It becomes really almost impossible to remember these things. And you don't want to write them down on sticky notes or put them in email because they're in plain text. People can steal them and run away with them. Just a bad idea. Well, that's where LastPass comes in and saves us all, because LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, where you're at, on any computer and any mobile device. All you have to do is remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on using LastPass on my desktop, but it was so useful, I actually started using it on all my devices. In fact, I even have a browser add-in that makes it easier, and it works on multiple browsers. It works on Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more. Plus, they have some pretty great mobile support as well, both on Android and iOS. Now, LastPass is so on the ball. They actually already have updates for iOS 12 and Android Oreo, which is good because just got my XS Max here that I'm going to try out today. So I'm going to pop LastPass on there as well. Now, I remember the day I got a call at work from my family, and they needed that password for the bank account to make a payment. Now, did I remember? Of course I didn't. I just basically visited the LastPass vault and used that my one and only master password, and bam, I could give them the password. Now, LastPass literally saved me time, which is money for me. So that's a great tool to keep you moving. Now, I'm talking about my personal account with LastPass, but they also have LastPass families for the entire family, and LastPass works amazing for enterprise too. Now, enterprise is always battling people trying to breach their networks. Now, check out this piece of data. 81% of breaches are caused by weak or reused passwords. Plus, the survey shows that 30% of employees actually share passwords with others. Now, LastPass makes it easy to use unique, random passwords that your employees don't have to remember or write down. And actually, in large organizations, people actually have to share passwords, and that's pretty hard to do securely. So they don't want to pass a sticky note across. So LastPass makes it easy for your org to share passwords as well securely. Now, plus, it allows a lot of customizations around access. In fact, organizations can set master password requirements, restrict access to specific devices and locations, enable password resets, and a ton more. In fact, they also offer multi-factor to block those attackers that they're not able to use the authenticator. And plus, get this, this will essentially raise eyebrows with IT admins out there. They also have Active Directory integration. Now, employees can log into their LastPass with Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly only have one password to remember, and that's their AD password. Now, for me, that actually makes it really easy because, in fact, my AD integration doesn't even require a password. I just use an authenticator for that, and so now I can actually access LastPass as well with only using one single authentication, which is super cool. Now, LastPass is enterprise and can configure. You can actually configure a ton of policies, 100 policies, access security reports, and create shared folders. You can actually also do a ton of other stuff. You can store a bunch of stuff there, including database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and more. Honestly, I love this tool. I need LastPass. I use LastPass. I'm a user of LastPass for life. Now, more than 13 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That is LastPass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support in this week and enterprise tech. Well, welcome back, folks. We're talking with Paul Reynolds, CEO and co-founder of that neat 3D prototyping tool called Torch. Paul, I want to actually ask you really quick. I think there a bunch of people in the chat room, and I think Bleeblurp is actually asking. That's hard to say really fast. Bleeblurp. He actually asked a question. He said, "Hey, you know, I've used Unity, I've used the Unreal Engine before. Now you come from the gaming industry. Was this kind of like inspiration for how you got to Torch and how? Because it's actually easier than those things because those are really scripting types engines, right?"
Yeah. So. The way we see ourselves as complementary to those. So to me, the game engines currently are the best way to produce and deploy these applications on the production side. So we're really focused on trying to get people iterating more quickly on the pre-production side because that just hasn't been possible. But yeah, so actually when I was at Magic Leap and we were architecting the first SDK and we were trying to figure out the third-party developer ecosystem, we fell into pretty much the same logic that all of these new platforms have, which is Unity and Unreal are the easiest forms of game development we've ever had. I came from a world of every studio built their own engine and tools, and there was a lot of investment. And then finally it got democratized a little bit to the point where, you know, if a high school kid comes up to me and says, I want to get into video game development, I don't hesitate to say, you know, go download Unity for free and do the tutorials, because that is a great way to get into video game development. And so we were in that mentality when we started thinking about these new platforms of video games are real-time 3D and interactive. Most of these interactions and applications are in 3D. So let's just create plugins and support for these existing game engines. What we came to realize is as we started looking outside of gaming and people building non-gaming applications and also looking at, you know, that same how are mobile applications and cloud applications built today? That's when we realized even the easiest form of game development, it still just does not mesh well with, you know, the development of web and mobile. It's just a totally different world. So, you know, kudos to anyone that can be productive in a game engine without any prior background in working in 3D, because it is not easy to do. And there are people that can, you know, prototype in those game engines, but where they fall short is they don't allow collaboration very easily. And so it's, that's why I consider them, you know, it's like, I wrote a blog post about this, you know, it's like the game engines are kind of the printing press, and it'd be like trying to prototype just an idea by running it all the way through a printing press and taking a look and then making changes. So we want to get that iteration faster on the design and kind of concepting side first. But we do want to play, you know, well with those production environments.
Right. Now, Cheaper, you had some questions about the application, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm listening to this. I'm seeing, wow, these are really cool tools. Can't wait to play. But you know what? I'm getting flashbacks of Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. And, you know, the problem is Second Life actually kind of got killed because the tools weren't there yet. Everybody saw Snow Crash and they wanted Snow Crash. Do you feel like you're one of the architects of that coming world?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Neil. He's actually an employee of Magic Leap, and I have worked with him on some things. So, it's definitely a totally new green field. It's just so different in terms of how we display information, how input works, how it's deployed, how all these devices work. It's just so different from the screen-based stuff. And what I look to pretty often is how we transitioned from desktop computing to web and from web to mobile. And there's some pretty recognizable patterns that happen there. As the web started early, there wasn't there wasn't very many tools. Not too many people could actually do much with it. It seemed almost silly. Why would we ever use that? And then as the audience started building and the market started building, then brands and enterprises said, well, we should have a presence online. And, you know, maybe not that, no core business, no transactions, but at least a presence. And then finally we took it seriously and said, oh, we can actually build software and applications on this. And we saw the same exact thing happen with mobile. And we're seeing that same thing happening with these 3D platforms. People with emerging tech R&D budgets or brands that are looking to set themselves apart before anyone else, they're starting to explore these platforms, and the tools are very difficult to get into because they're just so different from anything they've worked with in the past. A much bigger transition than it was to go from a desktop application to a web app to a mobile app. I mean, it's just so many new factors and more complexities that the tools have really got to unlock that. And that's exactly the opportunity that I saw that I wanted to pursue, that I saw was holding up, you know, if it's VR, if it's AR or some other R, or, you know, volumetric monitors or some other type of 3D input. I do believe that we are going to be moving beyond traditional software development techniques and practices. And I think it's going to be very visual. And I think this unlocks a lot of stuff for computer science majors, you know, people that already have an aptitude for logic, you know.
Actually, there's an app that I've been wanting forever and ever and ever. I do a lot of field ecology at the University of Hawaii, and a researcher and I have wanted to be able to go and have an AR view of, say, a valley, and be able to overlay things like rainfall, grass growth, things like that. I'm almost thinking, why don't we go to that video you have about example building AR experiences around physical objects?
Yes.
And
yep.
You can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
why don't we head to that, Alex? Alex?
Sorry, which one was this?
Sorry, the third one. Example building AR experiences around physical objects. And that'll give us a little bit of an example on how to see how Torch will allow me to do AR around physical objects, right?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, this was, this is a prototype. This was to show this is a company that builds this adventure van outdoor, this large, bulky hardware, these bumpers, roof racks, and ladders. And so what we're showing here is how you may want to do a virtual try-on with your van. So how that would work in AR is you'd need to calibrate your location a little bit. So we use the grill emblem on the van. And then once you set that calibration, then we roughly know where the roof rack is going to be, and we roughly know where the ladder is going to be. So we just showed an example of how you could overlay or annotate. So that first rack one was kind of always facing the camera, and then this ladder annotation is actually attached to the side of the van. And so to me, those are some of the unique aspects of these technologies is the ability to place virtual information, data feeds, and integrate it with the physical environment. That is one of the most powerful capabilities of augmented reality. And so to your example, we're really not that far off from you being able to visually arrange that. And the only thing that'd be really missing is connecting up the live data feed and you choosing how you want to visualize it. And I do think that that type of stuff is definitely coming down the road pretty quick.
Well, now, we've been talking about a number of different ways of using this technology, and I'm intrigued by some of the business applications. I've talked to people who are using augmented reality in things like airplane maintenance, especially in the field where they can look at different items in a jet engine. See what the item number is and go ahead and order it while they're still sitting there next to the wing. Is that kind of business application something that you're seeing as more possible to build with these tools?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you think about how the computing hardware required to show these class of experiences, they're actually contextually aware in some ways, right? They know a little bit of information about the environment they're in order to be able to place visual and interactable things in that real physical environment. So you have contextual awareness and you have this flexible display. So if you'd imagine how much you could increase the efficiency of a worker, like a field worker, usually they're lugging tools and they've got their smartphone and some field manuals. Then it's on them to still piece all this stuff together on what's the answer I'm looking for, what's the part I need. So if this is that opportunity to make that much more efficient because you know where the worker is, what they're looking at, the equipment that they're working on, you can overlay information. They don't need to rifle through these different, field guides and it can all be integrated. So it's like the equivalent of being able to bring your full-blown computer with you out into the field and having someone there that's kind of an assistant that knows. So there's tons of use cases around that increased efficiency. I mean, we talk a lot about augmented reality because I do think it has the most relatable use cases to enterprise. But VR has got some other compelling examples too, where you're eliminating physical limitations. So training in particular is really popular in VR because you can roll out training at scale to a lot of people. And you don't have to, especially training that requires a physical environment or certain steps to be performed. You can do that completely virtual, and once you've built that training application, you can deploy it, and people can run through it without all the overhead of a physical class or training environment being set up.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we ran out of time. Paul Reynolds, CEO, co-founder of Torch. We definitely want to have you back because I think Torch has a lot of good potential for applications, and we want to hear more about how you're doing that. But maybe you could tell the folks at home where they can actually go and try out Torch. How can they get started on Torch?
Yeah, so we're actually going to go into public availability on Monday. So if you go to torch.app, But if you just sign up on there, you'll get a notification when we go live. But it's just going to happen on Monday. So yeah, we're in the process of switching over. Torch.app and then Torch app on Twitter is the best way to follow us. We're going to be pushing out lots of use cases, recipes, how to integrate AR into your existing mobile app. And, we're going to be ongoing educating people on how they can use this in their business.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Game Assets. Now, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts, without whom I wouldn't want to do this show. I want to start with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, what are you up to? Where can people find you? Where can they find all the stuff that you're doing?
Well, I am still ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, on Twitter. And I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. Love to hear you. Love to get your show suggestions. Right now, I'm trying to rack up all the show bookings so that I can, go on vacation. I'm going to see one of my ex-students get married in Vermont. That's going to be awesome. And then, of course, Kurt and I are going to be going, hopefully, to the Gartner Symposia and also the Internet 2 meeting while I'm there in Orlando. So maybe if there's some Twilight Riot in Orlando at the Internet 2 meeting or the Gartner Symposium, we can go get together for some adult beverages.
Fantastic. Thank you so, Brian. Thank you, Brian, for being here. Now, Kurt, we'll have to sync up one while I'm in Orlando here in the next week. Where can people find you and what you're doing in the coming weeks?
Well, all of my writing is over at darkreading.com. Come over and take a look there. And I point to most of that through my Twitter feed at KG4GWA. Hope you're following me. And use that to go ahead and let me know if there are things that you would like me to talk about here on Twiat. In addition, I'm going to be at Ignite next week. I'll be tweeting what I see. The week after that, I'm going to be at Splunk's conference here in Orlando. And then while Chibert's in town, as he said, we're doing the Internet 2 Symposium and Gartner. So lots of being out and amongst the world over the next month. Would love to see the members of the Twilight Riot while I'm out there.
Fantastic. Well, Curtis, Brian, can't do the show without you. Thank you guys for being here. We look forward to having you on next time. Also, we also want to thank you as well. You're the person that drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show. You get all of your enterprise goodness from us. We couldn't do this show without you, and we want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise goodness and your news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twiat. There you will find all of our back episodes, show notes, information about the guests, and those little magic links to the right there where you actually be able to subscribe to the video or audio of your choice, whether it's HD video or regular video, as well as listen on any one of the devices that you want. And it also gives you the ability to actually stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So go ahead and subscribe and check that out. Now, once you do that, share it with your friends, family, and coworkers. We love doing this show, and we definitely can't do it without you. So go ahead and subscribe and do that. And also, if you're going to subscribe, you might as well check us out live at live.twit.tv. We go ahead and do the show each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific. Come see how the show is run and all the behind the scenes. Also, if you're going to jump in the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room live as well at irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room, and we get some great content and topics and questions from the chat room. So feel free to jump into that as well. Now, also don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You can find out what I do on my normal day job, as well as check out dev.office.com. That's what my team is working on. And of course, come out, check out all the content we're going to put out from Microsoft Ignite next week. Now, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Thanks to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. But I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit, as well as Mr. Brian Chi, our tireless producer, who finds and all the great guests and all the great content for the show. So thanks, Brian, for all of that. But of course, before we sign out, I have to thank our TD for today, Mr. Alex. Can you tell us maybe what the main topic of the show is today?
I believe it was something about sticks with fire on it, some kind of torch thing.
Oh, so close. No, I'm afraid the answer that we were looking for is AR/VR design velocity. But thank you so much, Alex, for trying.
As long as there's fire involved, I'm okay.
Fantastic. Well, maybe you'll get it next time. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you just want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWiET.